Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Live from the Nasdaq Market Site in the heart of New York City's Times Square, this is Fast Money. Here's what's on tap tonight. Shining Apple, the tech giant, surging to its highest level in 2 weeks as one top analyst says, buy the fear. Is the long lagging stock of the iPhone maker about to stage a comeback, or earnings put a damper on the parade? Plus, a Tesla turnaround, shares of the EV giant seeing their best day in over 3 years as CEO Elon Musk scores a big win in China. Can the stock keep accelerating, or will it hit the brakes again? And later, Paramount pressure, mixed earnings, a longtime CEO stepping down, and a deal potentially moving closer to fruition. What it all means for the streamer and the streaming space. I'm Courtney Reagan in this evening for Melissa Lee, coming to you live from the Studio B at the Nasdaq Market Site. On the desk tonight, we have Tim Seymour, Bono and Eisen, Dan Nathan, and Guy Adami. We will start with Apple's revenge. Shares jumping about 2.5% in the session and adding nearly $65 billion to the company's market cap just today, by the way. The stock closing above its 50-day moving average for the first time since January. The latest move coming after Bernstein upgraded the iPhone maker to outperform, telling investors to buy the fear. The stock had been down 12% in 2024 before today's call. But can the momentum carry Apple into earnings coming in on Thursday? Will it hold through all those numbers? Many of the big tech names that reported last week were under pressure today. Meta is down 12% since its report on Wednesday, for example. So should investors worry that Apple will fall into the same trap after its report? Or will it gain some appeal as a defensive play? Tim, you're nodding your head. What do you make of this call? They're saying, look, be Buffett-like at Bernstein. Buy when it's low.
Well, Tony Sacconaghi is somebody we all respect. He's had a great call on Apple, and I think he's picked out these moments. And I think the core to his thesis is that Apple is relatively cheap to the market, relatively cheap to itself. But that his call that China is more cyclical than structural, I think, is interesting. I think that could be challenged. But there's no challenging the fact that Apple's really underperformed the market. It's really underperformed the other Mag 7 other than Tesla. So today was like the revenge of the Mag 2. And Apple's underperformed the Nasdaq 100 by 20% from early December. So, you know, you can track this thing. It has been a big laggard. It's certainly something that's needed a catalyst. You never count Apple out. There's certainly no AI or to the extent that you're going to have a refresh in the iPhone cycle and there's something coming up, great. Let's see. It's certainly not a bad call given how much Apple's underperformed. I like that kind of a call by an analyst.
Yeah. Bottom line, I was thinking, I mean, it couldn't necessarily be a bad bet, but is it defensive? I mean, do we even want to count it as magnificent anymore?
I think it's still magnificent because, you know, you look at that balance sheet, there's still a margin of safety. I think perhaps we're kind of going to change our definition of what exactly is magnificent is, right? That was, you know, out of this world growth coupled with a margin of safety. I think now, given a market that's shown some ebbs and flows and some, you know, some puts and takes, perhaps the margin of safety is what's going to cause you to still label it as magnificent. With that said, you know, I'm just not sure I see the upside. I do think the downside is mitigated. Tim pointed out how it's been a laggard, and you definitely want to kind of look at those type of contra trend trades. But in terms of the upside, and that's really where the magnificent question really comes in. You know, I doubt they're going to come out in earnings and say, listen, we've absolutely knocked the cover off the ball in terms of China sales. In fact, we're expecting, you know, we've been keeping this AI tool under wraps forever. And now we were going to, release this. And this is going to lead to a reacceleration of growth and a reacceleration of service revenue growth. So I don't think that you have that rabbit in the hat, so to speak, that's going to be a surprise. With that said, I do think expectations are relatively muted. And I think the news with Tesla and China might bode well for at least there being some warm spots and what's shaping up to be a bit of a, you know, a cold technological war.
Those are some really good points. I mean, Dan, you're not really expecting any fireworks out of this Apple report to really move the stock higher.
No, I mean, listen, my panelists made some great points right there. There it is. Oh, no, Bono, and I think you kind of nailed it, too. One thing I want to say about Tony, and I know we've all followed his work for over two decades, he is not afraid to make contrarian calls. He's not afraid. He has been on the right side of Tesla now for a couple of years. You know why? At Bernstein, they don't care about investment banking business, right? Because that's not what they do. And Tony's a great analyst. So I like him getting in front of it. I don't think there's any catalyst that's going to come out on the call. I just don't think that there's anything about their China business, 19% of their revenues. Some expectations are that iPhone's down 19% year over year. So the fact that you have that whisper number out there, that's pretty good. I would be surprised if it's down more than that. But the point about, you know, generative AI and what they come up with, there's been lots of reports that they're talking about to OpenAI to license that. Whatever they do will be on the phone coming out in September, October, November. I don't know if that's much of a catalyst right now. I'd love to see this company kind of de-risk from a guidance standpoint right now. Maybe they give cautious guidance for the balance of the year. And then you could say, all right, I want to buy this stock at $160 or something like that into WWDC on June 10th, because you know you will get some announcements. Whether they're positively received or not is another story. But to me, I actually think the stock is kind of expensive. If you think about this, earnings growth at best, high single digits, sales growth at best, mid-single digits for the next couple of years, trading about 24 times, it's just not that cheap. And I know Tony spent a lot of time talking about free cash flow generation and the way he looks at it from a valuation standpoint. He thinks it's cheap relative to itself. What Tim just said, I just don't know if there's anything right here, right now, that says to buy it. I'd rather buy it a little weaker with worse sentiment into WWDC.
Guy, does it feel defensive, though?
It has been, without question, on horrible market days. You know, Apple is one of those stocks that will go up regardless of what it had been doing in the prior couple of days or the prior couple of weeks. So I think at times is very defensive. I don't think in terms of valuation it's defensive at all. We've all talked about it, and throw in the fact that margins have been flatlining for probably the last year, year and a half. And you say, you know what, this is probably expensive stock. I think we get seduced by the fact that it's Apple. If it was any other company, I think we would look at an evaluation and say, this is expensive. And this stock has not performed now since July of last year on a broader market that's done pretty well. And I think what will happen is, and I admire Tony as well, but if they come out and miss or the stock trades lower, they will defend that call and they will reiterate that call, as they should. The question is, you know, can you stomach $12 to $15 of downside? Or is this something you say, you know what, I want to be in it. I don't care if the stock goes lower. Because this is sort of a, you know, this is one of those transcendental stocks that you need to be in. I still think there's some room to the downside.
I keep thinking about AI and how Apple plays into this. We've all sort of danced around this, and obviously they've had Siri for a long time. But, I mean, what else could they possibly say about generative AI, or AI, I guess, of any kind, that would really jazz up investors? I mean, maybe they don't have to be first, but maybe they can be best. Maybe they can do it better than anybody else.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I ultimately... The AI trade is not directly associated with what Apple's going to give you. But I do think that the handset, the ability to also have the computing power at some point to really deliver on a lot of the underlying app strength. Sure. I get back to a company that Guy's talking about its defensive nature and down days. Absolutely. A couple of those big down days, Apple was flat. And the risk reward on a down tape to Apple relative to its peer group, I think, is very compelling. If you look at the dynamic around their services business and the gross margin support that it gives the company and the free cash flow generation that Tony at least references, you know, you're talking about 45-46% gross margin. This is something that's really attractive. The services business isn't as sexy of a driver to the company and to the valuation, and it's something that I think will be very defensive in difficult times. I think we're all saying something similar, which is that the company's not priced to perfection, although it's not cheap. And so you have something here going into those numbers where I think nobody's expecting anything. I think the bar is very low. And I think we all know that the refresh cycle, as it gets into Dan's, you know, comment about in the fall, you know, that's really when you're going to expect this company to do something, but maybe you get something in June.
Bottom line, I mean, shares are only up 3% over the past year. Bigger risk they go down or they go up after this report.
Probably go up, but again, it's really about order of magnitude. I wouldn't really call a 3% move the grand revenge tour, right? And I'm just not. I do think it's positive they've broken through that 50-day. That gives you some type of short-term catalyst that you can kind of hang your hat on and ride that momentum. But even he is suggesting that you trade this between a range of 25 and 30 one-year forward numbers. And so, like, keep in mind, this is not him saying back up the truck. The valuation, you know, compels one to add this as a core position. He's saying this is not now an entry point, a compelling entry point for a trading position. And I think if you're approaching it from that standpoint, you understand that, sure, you know, I think that the risk reward is more compelling. However, the stock has not gotten to a point where you're now reallocating and taking dollars away from something else.
Yeah, I'll just say this. You know, the stocks that gapped up last week, I mean, look at Google, look at Microsoft. I mean, they looked like good reports. I mean, Google, I think, you know, was a better report and a better guide relative to expectations than Microsoft was, but they've actually filled in, or, you know, Google's on its way to filling in the gap. Microsoft's filled in that gap. And then we saw on the flip side what Meta did, what Netflix did, and a few others. There was just downright horrible price action. So if Apple were to have a little bit of a relief rally because it's not as bad as feared, I don't think that sticks. And I think that, you know, we're probably getting to a seasonally weak period. We're getting to a point where I think a lot of investors, and we're going to get a lot of color on interest rates this week with the Fed meeting and obviously the jobs report on Friday. But if we have a 10-year that's marching on its way to 5%, I think that this is the thing that has been a cooling agent for a lot of these big names over the last month or month and a half or so. And I think it will continue through the course of the summer until we have better clarity, when I think some investors can start to price in lower interest rates. But right now, I don't think it's here. So if this stock were to pop and get back above, I don't know, like get towards 180, I think you probably sell it and you look for a better opportunity into WWDC, which again is not that far from here. But that phone refresh cycle is a long ways away. And anything that they do licensing someone else's technology to go on their phone, they have not been great at doing that in the past. So I don't expect it to be a big driver for this 16 cycle.
Fair enough. You've kind of opened the door to a macro discussion. So I do want to talk about the yen, which is falling to another 34 plus year low against the dollar. The currency weakening to more than 160 yen per dollar for the first time since April of 1990, that were retreated from its worst levels amid reports that Japanese regulators could be intervening to prop up its value. So, Tim, what do you make of the volatility in the yen? I mean, I remember in 1990 when this happened. I'm just kidding. I don't remember that. But what do you make of the volatility here?
No, you cannot. You were not born.
I was born.
Come on.
First grade.
You know. BOJ's credibility is shot. And so that's what's going on here. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that everybody knows an intervention doesn't really work, historically hasn't worked, to some extent, the market then pushes as hard and hard as they can. Whether there actually was one or not, I think Guy's got a view that there was. I'll let him talk about that. I just feel like the ultimate message, though, for where interest rates are and for where central banks are around the world is something that's scary. This is not something that's sending a lot of confidence. I do think that yields have to go higher in Japan. I think the good news is also the bad news. They want inflation. They've had four decades of deflation. And ultimately, as we've talked about many times on this show, Japan is the largest buyer of U.S. treasuries. And that doesn't bode well here, especially when their buying power at 160 or 155 or even 145 is not what it was. And I do think it's a case where markets will push and push and push. That's what's going on in Japan right now. And it's not positive for the sense of volatility in markets overall.
Guy.
Something happened last night because it traded up to 160. I think it was like 10 o'clock our time. And within minutes, it was down to 156 and changed, 155 and changed. So whether or not it was an intervention that they're going to announce or something happened to that, something clearly did happen, number one. Tim is spot on. Their credibility is shot. I mean, they can intervene all they want in their currency. It's not going to work. In order for something that work, they have to raise rates in a meaningful way, but that will crater an economy that's already sort of on the brink. So they face a huge dilemma here. I mean, their currency is going to continue to weaken, which is really bad for the people that live there, or they're going to have to raise rates to defend their currency, which, by the way, is really bad for people that live there. And his point about owning treasuries, that's one of the many reasons I think that U.S. yields continue to go higher. So the fact that this is the third or fourth largest economy in the world and nobody seems to want to talk about it is staggering to me.
Yeah, but bring it back to U.S. and bring it back to a company that we were just talking about, Apple. Almost 60% of their sales come from outside the U.S. Mm. Just think about that. This is already a very expensive, aspirational product in most parts of the world. So you have a dollar, at least the U.S. Dixie, the U.S. dollar index, is up 4% year over year. Okay, so we're going to start hearing constant currency. We're going to hear that again and again. I've already heard it a lot on a lot of these conference calls.
Yeah.
And so, again, you're trying to figure out what is the organic growth, what is the organic demand, but some of that demand can be thwarted by the dollar translation here, and I think that's something that's here to stay for the balance of the year.
That's a really good point. And it isn't just earnings and the dollar on investors' radar this week. We also have the Fed decision, by the way, on Wednesday, the April jobs report on Friday. So for more on all of what this could mean for markets and stocks, let's bring in BMO's Chief Investment Officer, Young-Yu Ma. Young-Yu, thank you so much for joining us. I mean, obviously, we've got a lot of economic data on the calendar. recent economic data, we saw some surprises with the GDP number, for example, but then the PCE came in pretty much bang on. What are your expectations this week, and which economic data point is most important to the equity market?
Yeah, it's great to be here, Courtney. And definitely a lot of data this week. We do think that probably the most important thing will be some of the under-the-hood numbers with the jobs report. We actually think when we look at hourly earnings, when we look at labor force participation, we think that's going to set some of the tone for whether or not the market thinks that the inflation pressures will ultimately be on a downward trajectory over the medium term, or if we just face a very protracted battle, which Chairman Powell is probably likely to point to in his messaging on Wednesday. So we do think there's a lot of data that's going to come out. The Fed will probably be signaling a little bit of hawkishness to the markets, and the markets might reprice a little bit the prospect of actually having no interest rate cuts this year.
Wow. Yeah, obviously we've gone down from, you know, from six. And so we are far away from those initial expectations. We're almost at the end of April. When you put everything together, when you're looking at the economic data points, do you think it's going to be a sell in May type of year?
We don't think so. We don't think that's what's advisable here. We actually think the growth drivers are in place for the second half of the year. We think corporate spending is starting to pick up, and that will be a big driver for the year. And we think that as long as inflation can remain relatively stable, that the investors and the market can focus on that growth and profitability that's starting to improve. And we can overall see a favorable trajectory, but we are going to have some push and pull because the more growth we get, we'll probably see some upward lift in those long-term treasury yields, which is just going to cause some tension in the market. So it's not going to be a straight line, but we do think ultimately the growth is going to win the day and provide a healthy backdrop here.
Young Yu, it's Tim. Thanks for joining us. So maybe that's framing the answer to my question, which is you're a CIO, you're managing risk, you're thinking about allocation. Seems to me that the market has kind of decoupled with the reality of not only not five cuts, maybe not any. And so do you think that? And do you think that changes the thesis for equities here?
You know, it's definitely not a Goldilocks scenario anymore. I think it does change the backdrop. We don't expect the markets to just be this constant grind higher. But I think that overall, if we think about how do we want to allocate risk, we still want to have a healthy allocation of risk, and we still want to look for areas we think can outperform. But no, it's no longer the Goldilocks scenario of having falling inflation, a Fed that's cutting rates aggressively, and strong growth. That just wasn't going to last for very long.
So you heard us hopefully had the conversation about the Bank of Japan and yields, and you don't have to agree with us, but how important are 10-year yields? And, you know, I think we're on the way to 5%. The market doesn't seem to care right now. Should it, or where will it?
I do think it's important. I think the market will start caring if we get start knocking on the door of 5%, and certainly if we get beyond 5%. We hit 5% in late October of last year, so there's a little bit of experience we've had now with 5% that definitely jarred the markets at that time, perhaps caused the markets to be a bit immune to another trip toward 5%. But I think that if we do get a push past 5%, that's going to be much more of a wake-up call for the markets that that level that we reached before could be surpassed and perhaps substantially. So we do think it's a big risk in the markets here, and it is something that we think the markets are going to be very sensitive to the 10-year Treasury yield over the next few months.
A lot of factors to balance. Thank you for helping us try to do just that, Young Yu. Appreciate you being here with us. Bonawyn, what do you make of everything that's to come on the economic calendar this week and how you're going to put that sort of into your calculus? Knowing we also have to balance Amazon earnings and Apple earnings, NVIDIA also coming up.
I think heading into the week, this is a huge earnings week, and I think that's really where the focus tends to shift. I think we've gone from expecting 5 to 6 cuts almost unanimously across people polled to now saying zero. And now there's actually whispers about possible more hawkish or, dare I say, rate hike. So I think that macroeconomic backdrop has kind of shifted. The GDP number also, I think, throws in a bit of a question mark. You know, we're expecting, you know, 2.8, 2.7%, and I think we came in about around 1.8, right? Couple that with PCE, which was slightly hotter. I just think it's hard for us to now say that we're clearly still in this soft landing Goldilocks scenario, which makes me, again, refocus on earnings. And you asked earlier in the segment about, you know, whether or not I'm looking at margin of safety or their Magnificent Seven example. I still am looking to that complex to an extent. I mean, clearly, you know how I feel about NVIDIA. I mentioned, you know, Meta. I think that's a bit of a unique situation there where they're now reaccelerating spending, and we saw how the stock reacted there. I do expect that to present an opportunity. Apple, again, I think there's a defensive aspect there. And I think Google, I think that was a surprise. I think that stock has been pretty flat for some time, and I think they had strong earnings there, a new dividend. I still think there are pockets of the market where you can play. I just think that it's going to be a lot more earning dependent and not so much about a thesis around when and how much the Fed is going to cut.
All right. Well, coming up, we are watching Paramount after hours. Shares on the move after the company's earnings report. How the CEO stepping down will impact the future of the company and the latest on deal talks. That's next. And by the way, speaking of earnings, SoFi getting hit after their report this morning. What has investors heading for the door on this fintech heavyweight? We will explain when Fast Money returns. We're back in two. Still got a lot of show for you.
You're watching Fast Money here on CNBC. We'll be right back.
From their innovative practice facility to unmatched views from the fairway, the PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with 5G solutions from T-Mobile for Business. Together, we're using AI-powered analytics to expand coaching tools and bringing fans closer to the pros with 5G-connected cameras. This is game-changing innovation. This is the PGA of America with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Wouldn't it be great to have all your investment and retirement accounts in one place? Yahoo Finance, our sponsor today, makes it easy. I use it to put my investment account and 401k accounts into one hub and get expert tips that help me confidently manage my money. For more than 25 years, Yahoo Finance has been the brand behind every great investor. Whether you're a seasoned investor or are looking for that extra guidance, Yahoo Finance gives you all the tools and data you need in one place. They're the number one finance destination, producing a holistic look at the financial news cycle, including breaking news, original editorial perspectives, analyst ratings, independent research, customizable charts, and so much more. Securely link your brokerage accounts for a unified view of your wealth, including 401k and other investments. A comprehensive perspective is what sets apart great investors, and it's how Yahoo Finance ensures you have the insight to look at your wealth in its entirety. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com. That's yahoofinance.com.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Earnings alert on Paramount. Shares volatile after the company reported an earnings beat, but a revenue miss for the first quarter. Paramount also announcing the departure of CEO Bob Bakish and outlining a new leadership plan. Julia Boorstin has the details. What did we learn from the conference call, Julia? There's a lot of moving parts in this story.
We learned basically nothing from the conference call. It was only 9 minutes long with zero Q&A. The company just reiterating its big news that CEO Bob Bakish is out, replaced by a newly created office of the CEO, which consists of CBS CEO George Cheeks, Showtime MTV Entertainment and Paramount Media Network CEO Chris McCarthy, and Paramount Pictures and Nickelodeon CEO Brian Robbins. Now, these three men are meant to work closely with CFO Naveen Chopra and the board, but there was no comment on who Chopra reports to, who oversees streaming, and whether this is meant to be temporary or permanent. Now, today's changes do seem designed to make it easier for the company to do a deal. But there was no word on Skydance's best and final offer for Paramount Global made yesterday, or whether Sherry Redstone, controlling shareholder, will entertain an offer from Apollo and Sony, which is expected to come as early as this week. There was also no word on tomorrow's deadline for Paramount to negotiate a deal with Charter, which, Courtney, is a very big deal for its value.
Absolutely. There's so many questions unanswered. Only 9 minutes and no Q&A. Well, fascinating stuff. Thank you, Julia, for keeping us up to date on that. Dan, what do you make of this? A lot of news flying around this company. What's best? What did you want to hear? What do you still want to hear?
No, I don't really care what happens. But I would say this, with Berkshire, largest shareholder, I'd take the Apollo-Sony deal and walk away, because it seems like a big stinking mess.
Yeah, it does seem like a big stinking mess.
Well, what's interesting is National Amusements, this is the Redstone family entity that controls 80% of the stock, can do whatever they want anyway. So, fair. It's clear the Skydance Skydance deal, which is one that's also coming from funding from Skydance, but also Redbird Capital. I mean, it's a who's who of media that are involved in this. And it's a very interesting deal because I believe this is going to begin to unlock. There's a bunch of other assets out there in the media space. WBD right there for a place that's well off its, you know, off its highs, but also the sum of the parts dynamics around what are those assets really worth. We know where linear TV is. We know where some of the streaming business is. The amount of subs that even Paramount has is pretty impressive, all things considered. So that's why this deal is why we care about it. Dan's right. I mean, you know, to the stock market, nobody cares about Paramount. No one has for a long time. And Netflix is so far out in front of everybody in terms of their streaming business. But it's a fascinating time. And again, some of the smartest folks in media are in and around the hoop on this. I think it's interesting.
So it's about the streaming landscape, Bonwin.
It's about the deal. I mean, I think the 9-minute earnings call tells you all you need to know in terms of where the focal point really is. Removing of a CEO, replacing them with a group of three. I think there's too many, you know, cooks in the kitchen or chefs in the kitchen, chefs in the soup, whatever the saying is. it seems a bit chaotic, but I think, you know, it draws a lens squarely on getting the deal over the finish line. And I think that there is still that wiggle room in terms of the majority of the minority vote. I think that could sway things to an extent. But as Tim mentioned, Redstone owns whatever it is, 75-80%. So this is really about the deal. I don't really think focusing on earnings or streaming. I think that landscape may look drastically different 6 months or a year from now under new leadership and under, presumably, a new merger agreement. Mm,
fair enough. Well, meanwhile, we've got a buzzkill for you on SoFi Technologies, the stock plunging over 10% despite an earnings beat as guidance for the second quarter came in lower than expectations. The CEO saying on Squawk on the Street this morning that 2024 is a, quote, transition year for the company as it shifts focus to areas outside of lending. SoFi did raise its full-year guidance. So should we expect to pick up in the back half? Tim, what did you make of this report? A little messy.
Well, to the extent that this is a company that also has had a lot of volatility in its share price because there's been different dynamics around their core business, and ultimately, I think this is just another question there. If you think about a world where funding was at X, it's now at X plus 500, and rates are staying higher for longer, that to me is squeezing a lot of businesses like this that I think don't have necessarily the same access to capital. Having said that, there's nothing wrong with the underlying. It's really just a question of in this environment after a snapback move, this is a pullback off of what had been, you know, a snapback move.
Snapback, pullback, guy.
6.75 is a level that's held a bunch of times. We're basically right there now. We're there now. Analysts want clarity, I guess, on basically their loan book. And I think that's what they're probably struggling with. But again, this is a stock you trade. Steve Grosso's brought this up a number of times. I mean, I think you're sort of at the lower end of the range. It's sort of 6.5, 8.5 thing. And I'd rather own it here than sell it here at $7 and change.
Okay. Yeah, down more than 10% in trading today. There's a lot more fast to come. Here's what's coming up next.
You don't have to do much digging. The mining trade is up next. Why one copper producer could be headed for a breakout. And why the CEO is feeling the metal mania. Plus, just when you thought this trade was out of charge, Tesla bounces back. The headline driving today's bounce and why China might just be throwing a bone to CEO Elon Musk. You're watching Fast Money, live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. We're back right after this.
From pit lane to podium, the Las Vegas Grand Prix is providing fans a race day experience at the speed they deserve. With the help of T-Mobile for Business, our 5G advanced network solutions are powering race day operations with event-wide connectivity. From streamlined gate entry to an immersive app, giving fans blazing fast access to the sport they love. This is accelerating innovation. This is the Las Vegas Grand Prix with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Shares of Freeport-McMoRan closing at the highest level since 2011 today. The stock up more than 23% already this year as metal prices have soared. Gold hitting multiple records this month and copper on pace for its best month since 2016. Freeport CEO Richard Adkerson optimistic on that metal in particular. Take a listen.
The fundamentals for copper are very good, both from a demand standpoint and the challenges in meeting supply. The outlook for copper is very positive. I've never been more enthusiastic about it.
Guy, this was one of yours you pointed out today. What did you see in this chart?
Tim, too. I mean, I like everything about it. I mean, forget about valuation for a second. I mean, it's effectively, there are a lot of sub-stories. It's a copper story, and copper is breaking out, and there's a supply-demand imbalance in copper that's not going anywhere soon in terms of getting better. And Freeport wins to this. So we're within sort of an earshot of the all-time high, I think, made in the spring of 08. And quite frankly, I think we get there. Richard Adkerson's, he's been there forever. And, you know, he's not one for hyperbole. And when he sees this kind of environment, he knows of what he speaks. So I think you stay with it here.
Tim?
I agree. 26% in copper since February 9th, a dynamic where there are supply shortages. There's always volatility in terms of the supply chain in copper. But what was interesting about Freeport's numbers is, in addition to, yes, there were higher gold and higher copper prices that were modeled in, and you get to these kind of higher prices, it becomes almost a mechanical follow-through from analysts where they have to. You know, we're now five-tenths through the year, almost, where you have a dynamic that they have to upgrade some of the copper and gold pricing in their models. But the production and operations costs were down 11% year over year. That, to me, is the whole story in the space. These companies are run differently. They're run better. There's been some concern that gold miners especially haven't really responded to the higher gold price because they don't have the operating leverage in their business. I think that's starting to change. I think that's something we're starting to hear. Guys, right, this is mostly a copper play. Look at Southern Copper, ticker SCCO. Then if you look around the world, I mean, there's a number of plays in Peru. You have Antofagasta. You have different ways you can play it. But Freeport, certainly over here, is a name people know.
All right. Well, coming up, still some charge in this trade. Tesla clearing a major hurdle in China as CEO Elon Musk makes a surprise visit. What it all means for the future of the EV maker in Beijing, those details are next. Plus, home sweet, nope. Why the American dream of home ownership may be even further out of reach, and why renting may be easier on your wallet. All of that when Fast Money returns.
Missed a moment of Fast? Catch us anytime on the go. Follow the Fast Money podcast. We're back right after this.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Stocks kicking off the week in the green as investors look toward another big batch of earnings, as well as the next Fed decision. That's on Wednesday. The Dow jumping nearly 150 points. The S&P and the Nasdaq both up about 0.3%. And shares of Delta up another 1% today, trading at its highest level in more than 3 years. That stock now up more than 25% this year. And some more after-hours action to watch. Lattice Semi lower on disappointing second quarter revenue guidance. NXP Semi, that's higher after an earnings beat. F5 sinking as revenues miss and guidance as well. Chegg dropping after announcing its CEO will step down, as well as posting its own disappointing revenue guidance. And Tesla closing the day up more than 15% following Elon Musk's surprise visit to China over the weekend. It was the stock's best day since March 2021. The company passing a major hurdle to roll out its full self-driving technology in the EV maker's second largest market. Phil LeBeau joins us now with more on this key trip. There has been so much Tesla news recently, Phil. Tell us the latest.
Well, Courtney, the importance of this is because China has been so important and so lucrative to Tesla, and yet it hasn't been able to get full self-driving subscription revenue from that market. That could be changing. Here are the details of the deal that was announced by Tesla in China over the last 24 hours. It will expand its autonomous drive technology, the ability to use more of its technology there in that country. And it doesn't immediately mean the FSD rollout, but it does clear the path for that to happen. And we've been told by sources that Baidu will be a company that is providing some technical details to support Tesla, including mapping, which is critical in that country. You mentioned that China is Tesla's second largest market. A lot of people refer to it as the largest market, with 33% of its sales coming in that market. And it has long had very successful operations there. But the key here is you want that monthly subscription, if at all possible. That's the allure of FSD, certainly the allure for investors. Here's what FSD looks like here in the United States. And again, this is just pricing in the U.S. When you buy a Tesla, you can pay $8,000 right now. That's down from $15,000 about 15 months ago. Or you could do a monthly subscription of $99 a month. That's the key here, that monthly subscription. Every automaker is chasing it right now. The take rate, it's unclear, though some have estimated it could be as much as 10% of the Tesla buyers who actually go for that monthly subscription or buy FSD. As you look at where Tesla is in terms of utilizing and tapping that market, keep in mind that the company did say in January approximately 400,000 customers through its entire history have bought FSD or have subscribed to it. We don't know what the current level is, and we also don't know the revenue that Tesla gets from full self-driving. And that, at the end of the day, Courtney, that is the key. As you take a look at shares of Tesla, yes, we know the robotaxi gets a lot of attention because Elon talked it up on the call last week, and we'll see the unveil in August. We don't know any details behind robotaxi. We don't know when that might become a reality, if it becomes a reality. But full self-driving, the key here, Courtney, is that monthly revenue. Every automaker is chasing it. And by the way, nobody has cracked it. Nobody has figured out how to get it to the level that you get with an Apple iPhone. So these are the kinds of things that they're working on, and that's the importance of this for Tesla.
Quite a day. Thank you for walking us through all the big developments, Phil. Appreciate it very much. Dan, I feel like I was here maybe last week or something, and you were talking about Elon Musk and if he's all over the place when it comes to his direction leading all these different companies. What do you make of this? I mean, this seems like a signal. At least Morgan Stanley's Adam Jonas says, hey, he's back. He's paying attention.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I mean, listen, back in January, Elon was whining about the Chinese companies were going to demolish every other EV maker if there's not trade barriers put up against these cheaper cars going around the world. And I just find it really interesting that he goes over there and has this meeting with this premier that he's has a special relationship with, and they come out with an announcement without any real details about it. And so to me, I think, you know, I wouldn't hold your breath for when full self-driving hits in China. One of the biggest issues is they are a surveillance state, okay? And this company, Tesla's full self-driving, or it's called supervised full self-driving, they're not allowed to use that title because it is not does not meet the criteria to say it's autopilot, uses cameras, not LiDAR. And so the cameras are, from a surveillance standpoint, not something the Chinese are willing to put up, especially from a U.S. company. So to me, I think this thing has lots of potential hurdles here. So I'm just surprised the stock rallied this much off the news. I don't have a position. Last week when we talked a lot about it, I didn't think it was a good precedent of the earnings. I thought the delivery number, which was really bad at the start of the month, you know, took a lot of the, you know, air out of the story. But it probably has a little more room to run. If you just look at the chart over the last year, stock has had big rallies after its reported earnings, after big sell-offs on disappointing results and guidance.
Fair enough. Bono, what do you make of the potential partnership with Baidu, as Phil and some others have been reporting? Give any more credence to what we might be getting out of China, though, to Dan's point, we don't really know all the details.
Well, first and foremost, I think it's a positive, just in terms of at least there being, you know, some semblance of ability to move forward and reach an agreement here. So I do want to acknowledge that. I think the devil will be in the details, and the extent to which you actually are granted access, I think that actually bodes more positively for Baidu. That's the way that I would tend to play this. They're the ones that are licensing the information. Any sensitive information is going to be passing through them as a conduit, and that's going to be completely warehoused within the Chinese government. So I think that's really where the upside lies there. In terms of Tesla, I think it's really a sequence of events. They came out with earnings, you had disappointing EPS, you had disappointing revenue, you had disappointing deliveries, you had disappointing operating margins and income. So I think the fact that you're getting this news after all of that, I just don't think the sentiment on the stock could have been any more negative. I think it's really just about a counter trend trade. I think there probably is legs to this, but all in all, that downtrend is still very much intact. Mm-hmm. And again, I tend to lean towards Baidu as being the winner in this whole exchange.
Very interesting. I mean, Guy, if Tesla can crack China much more than it's done, I mean, this opens up a lot of opportunity, does it not?
What does that mean, though? Because Chinese companies have cracked China.
Yeah.
They're already full self-drive there, and there's seemingly no revenue on the back of it. So cracking it is one thing. Okay. Cracking it and getting revenue for it is something entirely different, I think. But I get it. The headlines are favorable. You still need a license for full service driving in China. I don't think there was any acknowledgement that they got that. All those things being equal, to Dan's point, Bonowin's point, yeah, I mean, it's in a 3.5-year downtrend, which has not been broken. It probably still has room, maybe to 215. Then you sell it again. I will say this, FXI, this is third, you know, tangential stuff, but FXI is holding in like a champ since those January lows. And I think Alibaba is getting ready for one of its moves that we've seen over the last couple of years to the upside.
Huh. Interesting stuff. Well, coming up, is home ownership really worth it? A new study shows it's now cheaper to rent than own in all of the biggest metro areas. The implications of this big switch for the housing trade, that's next. Plus, don't touch that dial. We've already kicked off another huge week of earnings. Apple, Amazon, and a whole slate of consumer names still on the docket this week. We'll tell you how options traders are gearing up for one of tomorrow's biggest reports. That's right after this. Welcome back to Fast Money. To buy or to rent, that is the age-old question. And if you live in any of the 50 largest metro areas in the U.S., a new report may have a surprising answer. CNBC's Diana Olick has more on that story. Diana, give us the facts.
Okay, Courtney, the rent versus own math used to play out differently city to city, but home ownership has become so expensive that renting a home is now cheaper than buying one in all 50 of the largest U.S. metro markets. And that's according to a new report from Bankrate, which compared monthly mortgage payments to current rents. Now, the monthly mortgage payment for a median-priced home, which is around $412,000, was $2,703 as of February of this year. That includes property taxes and insurance. Compare that to the national monthly rent of $1,979, which includes renter's insurance. That's a 37% gap between the two. Now, in 21 markets, the gap is actually 50% or more. Those include San Francisco, Seattle, Salt Lake City, Austin, Denver, and Dallas. Cities with the smallest gaps, although still more expensive to own, include Detroit, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, Cleveland, St. Louis, and Tampa. Now, these numbers are as of February, when rates were slightly lower than they are today. Rents have been easing despite rising demand because there is so much new supply coming on the market this year. Multifamily starts, however, have dropped sharply. So once that supply does get eaten up, rents could start to rise once again and change all the math again, Courtney.
And then, but how do you sort of factor in, of course, the whole idea of ownership versus renting, where, you know, you're not building wealth over time? I mean, how does that calculus sort of play into the value?
Exactly. Right. That is not in this equation. This is simply the monthly payment. And a lot of people will buy not on the home price, but on the monthly payment. So that's how they did this. Home ownership builds wealth. Historically, home prices have always gone up. There was the Great Depression and the Great Recession, and that was it. Otherwise, home prices over time will rise. Generally, 5 to 10 years you're going to stay in that home, you're going to build wealth. So it's just a question of how expensive a market you're in and how long it takes to start to build the wealth after you've put the money in, even if it is slightly more expensive on the monthly payment.
It's, of course, very fascinating, and in many of Americans' biggest asset is their home. So something really to think about and look at all these facts. Diana, thank you for laying it out for us. Tim, any thoughts? You were kind of nodding as Diana was going through this.
First of all, let's acknowledge Diana Olick knows a lot about housing, and she's been doing a great job for a long time and kind of reminding us what those trends are. I mean, that it sometimes it seems, and sometimes I get lost even in the macro that we have that are higher rates. And I do feel that there should be pressure on pricing, especially that whole segment that we just talked about. Ultimately, if it's cheaper, doesn't that mean that and a better option, doesn't that mean that rents are going to go higher? And doesn't that mean that prices for houses, which are so expensive, that prices have to come down because they're unaffordable? So that's kind of my view of the secular trends. But the dynamics here are really interesting. If you're investing in home builders, you've been kicking it for the last 6 months. And frankly, the valuations aren't even that awful. What's an interesting name is a Whirlpool, which is near, I think, 5-year lows, almost near its COVID low. They just had numbers out a week or so ago. Their margins were terrible. It puts a lot of pressure on the second half. This is an interesting company to me based upon where it's trading now. And again, that would be on a trailing or historical multiple. I think it's actually really attractive here. It's been killed.
Very interesting. Whirlpool for the housing trade. Well, coming up, Prime to report. Amazon earnings due out after the bell tomorrow. So we're getting a check in from the options pits to see how traders are handling that one ahead of the results. That's next. More Fast Money in 2. Welcome back to Fast Money. Amazon gearing up to report earnings tomorrow after the bell. The stock already up nearly 20% this year, having hit record highs earlier this month. And one options trader is making a big bet that tomorrow's results could unlock even bigger gains. Mike Coe joins us now with the action. What are you seeing, Mike?
Yeah, so Amazon's implying about an 8% move after they report earnings by the end of the week. Calls significantly outpacing puts by about 2-1 on above average volume. And one of the larger trades we saw today was a 2,000 lot of the August 190 calls. Those were trading for just over $10 a contract. That's an outlay of over $2 million in premium. And what I like about this trade is that they are looking out not just to this earnings, but the next one, giving themselves a little bit of time for this to pay off. And also defining their risk, because that, of course, is taking on the all-time highs, which we saw just recently.
Got it. Thank you very much, Mike. This is a big one. There's so many facets of this name, Dan. Obviously, the consumer, but people care so much about what's going on with AWS, AI. What are you looking for?
I think there's some things you could take away from Microsoft. They saw re-acceleration in Azure. Maybe that's taking share from AWS. But, you know, again, this could also go the way of Meta. If they are dialing up their spending as it relates to generative AI, that, you know, this is not something they're working on some of their own stuff, but they don't have what Microsoft has. They don't have what Google has. I could see the stock going lower on a fear of higher spending also. So to me, I think this is a tough one. I think you probably want to wait and see what they have to say.
Throw up a chart real quick. You're right up against those prior highs from the fall of 2021. And it's sort of like the Google trade. Either it's going to break out in a meaningful
way. Sounds like a big implied move here.
That's why it's a big implied move. So, I think it's a coin flip at best. I'd rather wait and see what happens. Hopefully they miss and buy the sell-off.
All right. Well, coming up next, it's already time for your final trades.
Wow.
It's time for the final trade. Let's go around the horn. Tim, you get to start.
Thank you, Courtney. Great having you. BHP miners, an integrated miner, not just copper, not just gold, but a little bit all over the place, a little reliant on China. I like it.
Bonawin.
Speaking of China, listen, I think this licensing deal is a positive. I just think it's more positive for Baidu. That's how I'll be playing it.
Dan?
Yeah, the Google had that big gap on that earnings and the guidance. It looks like it wants to fill it in. If it gets back towards 160, I think it reloads.
And Guy.
I know there's Sixer fans out there that watch Fast Money. I mean,
are there?
It's too bad.
I didn't know.
Number
Seems
one.
There'd be a lot of Knicks fans in Philly.
Courtney was talking a lot of smack before. Alibaba in the same vein as Bonawin.
Okay, thank you for watching Fast Money. Mad Money with Jim Cramer starts right now.
All opinions expressed by the Fast Money participants are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of CNBC, NBC Universal, their parent company or affiliates, and may have been previously disseminated by them on television, radio, internet, or another medium. You should not treat any opinion expressed on this podcast as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of an opinion. Such opinions are based upon information the Fast Money participants consider reliable, but neither CNBC nor its affiliates and or subsidiaries warrant its completeness or accuracy, and it should not be relied upon as such. To view the full Fast Money disclaimer, please visit cnbc.com/Fast Money Disclaimer.
From a flat tire in the city to a dead battery on a distant drive, AAA is partnering with T-Mobile for Business to accelerate response times and get more drivers back on the road fast. Our nationwide connectivity powers location telematics, so AAA's fleet can find stranded drivers quickly while being fully equipped with the in-vehicle tools to have answers when they get there. This is elevating the member experience. This is AAA with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.